Welcome to Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know. This is episode 4, Are Lethal Autonomous Weapons Ethical? You are listening to an interview with Özlem Algin, hosted by Paula Gaeta and Marta Bow.
Thank you very much, Private Ryan, and hello everyone. I'm Paula Gaeta, Professor of International Law at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies, where I lead a research project on lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes.
And I'm Marta Bo, a researcher in Paula's project and a researcher at the Aster Institute in The Hague.
This is episode 4 of a podcast series that is connected to my research project. If you want to know more about it, you can take a look at our website, lawsandwarcrimes.com.
This episode discusses the ethics of autonomous weapons and some of the problems and challenges raised by the development and use of autonomous weapons and AI in targeting. Our guest for today to help us answer some questions related to these issues is Özlem Algin.
Özlem is a reader in international law and ethics at the Birmingham City School of Law, and she holds a PhD from the University of Nottingham. Her research interests lie in the area of regulation of artificial intelligence and robotics. She specializes in moral and legal philosophy, covering weapons law, international humanitarian law, and public international law. Welcome, Özlem. We are very happy to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you.
Yes, welcome, Özlem. To our listeners, I should add that Özlem has written some very interesting articles on human dignity in the age of autonomous weapons and Kantian ethics in the age of artificial intelligence and robotics.
Okay, let's start with the interview, Özlem. And I will start with a very simple question for our listeners. In all your writings, you insist very much on the importance of the principle of human dignity in the laws of warfare, regulating hostilities. And here also in the development of new weapons, you think that the principle of human dignity plays a role, particularly through the so-called Martin's Clause.
It's a very good starting point. I'd just like to read out exactly what the Martin Clause says. And this is contained in Article 1, Paragraph 2 of the 1977 Additional Protocol 1 to the 1949 Geneva Conventions. It says the following: in cases not covered by this protocol or by other international agreements, civilians and combatants remain under the protection and authority of the principles of international law derived from established custom, from the principles of humanity, and from the dictates of public conscience. Now, those last two parts, where it refers to principles of humanity and dictates of public conscience, this is where the value, the right, and the duty of human dignity comes in. Because the law couldn't at that point identify clearly resistance fighters, those in occupied territories and smaller states, as having the competent status, this clause was offered as a compromise. This clause is pervasive through customary international law. It covers situations which are not provided for in the positive law, that's in the treaties, the agreements, or indeed custom. And it forces us to anchor our understanding of the law, interpretation of it, in terms of human value. What would the dictates of public conscience say is the appropriate thing to do in a certain circumstance? What are the principles of humanity? One of those is human dignity. And human dignity has been referred to by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in the prosecutor in Ferencvárosi case, 1998, as the following: the primary purpose of this body of law is to safeguard human dignity. The body of law it's referring to in that case is international humanitarian law. It also goes on to say in that case that the basic underpinning and the very raison d'etre of international humanitarian law and international human rights law in modern times, it has become of such paramount importance as to permeate the whole body of international law. Now,
interrupt you, Ozlem, because of course you are explaining very well in which way the Martin's Clause could be the basic, let's say, of the whole international humanitarian law for whatever it is not covered by positive law, as you say, and therefore it is the gate through which the principle of human dignity, you know, plays an important role in the laws of warfare. But now, more specifically on the question of autonomous weapon systems, in previous episodes, two guests, Tim McFarland and Marco Sassoli, have taken the view that the laws of warfare do not require that a human being, he's the one who has to take the ultimate decision to launch a military attack, taking the life of an enemy target, let's say an enemy soldier. Because according to them, what matters is that the rules of international humanitarian law, such as the respect for the principle of distinction between combatant and civilians and the principle of proportionality and so on, are respected. But ultimately, it doesn't matter whether the final decision to take the human life of an enemy combatant is made on the battlefield by a machine based on a software.
Yeah. Ozlem, and from your writings, what I get is that your position is quite against the position taken by Tim and Marco, and a very interesting and important argument that you make is that human beings are the center of the laws of warfare, and that this implies that relinquishing human decisions on deadly military attacks to a machine based even on pre-instructions encapsulated in a software of an autonomous weapons by a programmer, deprive the combatant and the targeted victims of their human dignity.
I think that we would like to know in a way, in which way, you know, the autonomous weapons, first of all, deprive the victim of the attack of the human dignity.
Yeah. So the entry point for this really is to understand human dignity as the status and as part of respectful treatment. And I developed this as a Kantian approach to human dignity. And if we look at human dignity as status, what it's actually doing in the context of the use of lethal autonomous weapon systems is denying the human targets that status. And the status is one that acknowledges humans have rational capacity, they have the ability to abide by and respect rules, they have the ability to change those rules. And in recognition of that capacity, there is status. And that status cannot be replaced or removed by a machine. Now, with the use of lethal autonomous weapon systems, these are systems that are actually being deployed in a context that I would say is for a relative end. And that is the desire to eliminate a human target in the hope that it will prevent others being harmed. But the very killing of another human being in the hope that it will prevent further harm is insufficiently morally grounded to override human dignity. So unless laws, lethal autonomous weapon systems, can only be used to track and identify a human target rather than eliminate the human target, then on this understanding of human dignity, it would be extinguishing a priceless, irreplaceable, objective end, which is a human being that has rational capacity. It's treating the human targets as an object, and it's treating the human targets as an object that can easily be removed, easily be disposed of, without there being an intervening act by a human being to consider. Is this an appropriate context to be using such a weapon? Is it the appropriate context to be actually attacking the target? Are they wounded? Are they about to surrender? Those areas of international humanitarian law require human agency. The machine cannot determine in a given context whether a person has been injured, has fallen, has surrendered, what to then do to respond. So on the combatant side, what it actually does is the deployment of lethal autonomous weapons, it creates a hierarchy of human dignity because it removes the combatant from the theatre of operation. It therefore removes human moral and legal agency to interpret and apply those very principles that you referred to earlier on, principle of distinction, principle of proportionality, and precautionary measures. Now, by removing the combatant from that theatre of operation, I say that this goes against the human essence of warfare, that there always needs to be human moral and legal agency for taking the life of another, and indeed in targeting and lethal force decisions. Now, once that human being is replaced by the machine, those who possess the capability, the technology of laws, are actually not putting their combatants at any risk. There's no risk there. And often you will find in the interpretation of a principle like proportionality, states will argue that a military advantage for them would be, one of the military advantages would be, to protect their own combatants. However, if we're talking about using laws in a theatre of operation, there is no risk to their combatants, the states that are possessing this technology. So they're completely removed from the theatre of operation. There is no military advantage that they can argue on that basis. And then commensurate to that, it's actually treating the human target as having a lesser human dignity, that it can be exposed to elimination by means of a machine without there being any human moral or legal agency to intervene to give effect to that decision, or indeed to prevent the killing in the first place. So there is an imbalance here. That's the hierarchy that's being created. The combatant, whose state possesses the technology, removes them from the theatre of operation. Meanwhile, the human target, that subject in that theatre of operation to an attack, will be attacked by this machine that doesn't have moral or legal agency. And therefore, there is a loss of the human essence of warfare. There's a loss of human interaction and interrelatedness, which actually is necessary for the application of international humanitarian law.
That's very interesting what you say, Özlem, because essentially you believe that the human agency cannot be relinquished under the laws of warfare. But as you know, there are many international humanitarian lawyers who take an opposite view. For instance, Marco Sassoli was asked to comment upon what he has written exactly on this point, and he says, and I quote, "I would never claim that robots can be more humane than humans, but I'm convinced that only humans can be inhumane." So my question to you is, in which way you are fundamentally in disagreement with him, if you are in disagreement with him?
Yeah, this is a very interesting point, because actually this is what I refer to as the irrational soldier argument. And this is often the argument that's put forward for justifying laws, lethal autonomous weapon systems. And that's this, that combatants in the theatre of operation can exhibit emotions which are debilitating and which can then lead to commissions of war crimes. And some of the things that are cited are fatigue or capacity for revenge. And these are put forward as examples of how human beings are flawed, and in particular combatants, and therefore somehow we could get rid of all of that, and machines would be more compliant, more moral, if you like, in some way. But that argument doesn't stand. And it doesn't stand because there is a misconception about the capacity of humans to control emotions, to also conduct themselves in accordance with values and the principles of IHL. Let's not forget that combatants are specially trained, so we're not expecting them to be committing war crimes. From the outset, they are trained, they have rules of engagement to be operating in a certain way. And let's be more specific than that. To be making a distinction when there's a combatant and when there's a civilian. if there is doubt as to whether they are dealing with a civilian, to exercise the presumption in favour that there is a civilian. If we look at precautionary measures which apply in international humanitarian law, that is specifically directed at humans, those who plan and decide upon an attack. So that's what I call the irrational soldier argument. Doesn't stand because of the lack of weight it gives to how human beings do operate, especially in combat, against rules that they have been trained with and that are inculcated in them. And it also is too optimistic about the capability of machines. Let's not forget that it's human beings who will be programming and developing these machines, and it's their desires, their intentions, their values that will ultimately be manifested in the machine. So I think that's quite a weak, if I may say, quite a weak argument to try and replace what are referred to as the irrational soldier tendencies with a machine. And if we just extend this a little bit further, there are many reasons why combatants may commit war crimes. There may be elements of post-traumatic stress disorder, there may be matters relating to lack of training or lack of equipment. But in any case, the law is very clear. In those instances, they act as the barometer as to what is acceptable and what is unacceptable in warfare. And that is something that machines cannot possibly contend with or indeed evaluate.
This last discussion brings us to another key point, namely the main reasons advocated in support of the development of autonomous weapons, which are essentially saving combatants' lives, better respect for the principles regulating targeting in warfare, less war crimes, and so forth. However, you argue that these arguments are based on an utilitarian and selfish approach by a group of powerful military countries. Can you tell us more precisely why these arguments are utilitarian and selfish?
Yeah, so from the utilitarian perspective, it's a sort of balancing of what is for the greater good. And often the argument put forward by the military and in these who support this approach to laws is that in issues such as the application of the principle of proportionality, commanders are having to make judgments, what is going to be in the greater good, and the proportionality requirement requires the commander to think, is there likely to be an excessive loss of civilian life as a result of an attack, and what is the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated from an attack? If the attack is going to lead to excessive loss of civilian lives, the law prohibits that. So often the utilitarian calculus, as I refer to it, is encapsulated there, or indeed how the military interpret it. Now, when we discuss laws, the arguments that are put forward, the first one is there's a moral duty to protect soldiers. Well, yes, that's true enough, but how far is that taken? Because actually, warfare is a unique context. It's a context within which individuals are highly trained to be engaged in combat and are very, very, very familiar with the prospect and the risk that they may be lost to their own life or indeed injury. So it's not a normal circumstance. If you replace the combatant with a machine or laws, it's in a way disregarding the professional training of that combatant and their own dignity derived from military codes of ethics based on discipline, courage, and restraint. But even those who argue for the moral duty to protect soldiers do not go that far as to say that laws should be introduced to replace combatants. As I mentioned earlier on, if you remove the combatant entirely from the theatre of operation and replace it with a machine, laws, there is no argument then to make that there is a military advantage in terms of protecting your own combatants and therefore to justify an attack. So that argument and that justification for the law is completely removed. The next utilitarian view that supports laws is that somehow there's going to be saving of lives and combatant lives, because there's going to be a sophisticated technology that's capable of leading to precision targeting. Even today, where we don't have fully autonomous weapon systems, we have what's known as human-machine interaction, or semi-autonomous systems. Even in those contexts, it's remarkably difficult for those in command and control centers to direct even precision targeting. This is assuming that there's programming based around algorithms, that the algorithms are correct, and that it will lead to the directed target. And the reason for this is there is a timing issue to these technologies. The timing issue of, is there a possibility for a human being to intervene at the last minute and to say, stop, something's gone wrong, we can't continue. And there are lots and lots of examples ranging from Afghanistan, Iraq, even in the first Gulf War, where the technology that's been deployed, bearing in mind it's not fully autonomous, but it's that human machine technology, the technology that's deployed hasn't led to precision targeting and has actually resulted in civilian loss of lives. So it's not a panacea to those contexts. It's not a panacea to preventing loss of civilian lives, or indeed protecting the combatant's life. As for the final utilitarian argument, I mentioned that earlier, what I referred to as the irrational soldier argument, that soldiers can experience debilitating emotions such as revenge and fatigue. These can lead to unpredictable behavior, which can lead to poor performance, unethical performance, which at the extreme end could lead to commission of war crimes. Now, just on this point, actually in complex situations where, let's say you have a mixed theater of operation, there's a mixture of civilians, there's a mixture of combatants, and very difficult decisions have to be made. In those contexts, that's exactly when human, what I refer to as human central thinking activities are needed. Judgment, situational awareness, exercise of discretion. These are things that cannot be replaced by a machine. So what has been perhaps referred to by some as negative attributes of human beings can actually be very positive, because in a highly complex and tense theatre of operation, it may be the human judgment which makes the entire difference as to whether an attack takes place, or indeed whether the attack will cause or lead to excessive loss of life, which the law will not condone. Just a final point on what you refer to as my utilitarian and the selfish approach that's been taken. If you allow states that possess this technology to proceed as they wish, they remove their own combatants from the theatre of operation, therefore they protect them, they're not at any risk, but any human target across the globe is at risk, unless they are in a jurisdiction that possesses the same technology. And there is a handful of states who can develop these technologies to such an advanced level that would be fully autonomous. And therefore, there is an immediate imbalance there. For this point of selfishly protecting your own combatants from harm and risk, which, by the way, is part of the law of combat and hostilities, but by doing that, a far greater risk and unpredictability is introduced into the international legal system. And that is, with the imbalance that's created, with the hierarchy of human dignity, with the removal of some combatants, it exposes human targets across the globe to lethal attack from such a machine, with unpredictability of when it's going to attack, where it's going to attack, and with no human, moral, or legal agency operating. That will create instability, because then you're going to get into asymmetric strategies, asymmetric tactics in warfare, by those states and entities who do not possess the technology.
Özlem, I'm sorry that I interrupt you, but you, what you say now is very interesting and stimulating. This brings me back to the codification of the laws of warfare, in particular in the field of means and methods of warfare and weapons law. Since the adoption of the very first international conventions on the martyrs, after all, even since the St. Petersburg Declaration or the Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907, the international regulation of the means and methods of warfare ultimately has always taken into account the utilitarian and selfish interests of powerful military countries. Therefore, we have had the prohibition of the dum-dum bullets, but I mean of chemical weapons, because this was in the interest also of these powerful military countries. So do you have any hope that in the field of autonomous weapon system, things may go differently?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective that you've introduced here, because if we look back to the creation of the Martins Clause, it was precisely to rebut that small state and great powers conflict and potential erosion of rights for the smaller states. And the Martins Clause introduces that balance. And I would argue that what permeates Geneva law and Hague law is actually a fundamental concern for the protection of civilians and fundamental concerns for principles of humanity. So I think there is hope in terms of the way in which the Martins Clause has been interpreted. It's part of customary international law, it's pervasive. And if we look at you've mentioned dum-dum bombs and other examples, but actually the huge one, which is nuclear weapons, the ICJ's advisory opinion in 1996 referred to the Martins Clause as an effective means of addressing rapid evolution of military technology. So it's not a matter simply in the hands of those who possess the capability to develop the technology. It's a matter of what were the initial aspirations and values for having Geneva law in the first place? What was the initial premise of having such a clause as the Martins Clause back in 1899 in the first place? And it goes back to anchoring the principles and conducting warfare, anchoring that back to humanity and anchoring that back to human dignity, as I would say. So I think the trajectory of some states trying to pursue it and developing it in one way is not enough and insufficient. And actually, when we look at Article 35 of the Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions, it clearly does state that states do not have unlimited choice of methods and means of warfare. There is some curtailment there, there is some limitation, and that's premised on these concerns: protection of civilians, principles of humanity, and human dignity. So it's not just a case of advancing the technology to achieve what it is that apparently is stated to be achieved. It's got to be commensurate with the underlying rules, which require that states cannot just simply introduce any and every method and means of warfare because they think it would favour them. It creates that imbalance in the system and actually distorts what international humanitarian law is about.
Pardon me. Keep your eyes on the clock, humans.
Yes, and this is our friendly non-lethal robot, Private Ryan. And Özlem is telling us that it is time to start wrapping up.
Indeed. Thank you, Paula. Would you allow me to ask Özlem the final question?
But of course, Ryan, go ahead, please.
Great. Özlem, if you please, how would you describe lethal autonomous weapons?
Creating a hierarchy of human dignity, creating instability in the international legal order, and removing the human essence of warfare, which is human moral and legal agency.
She had those locked and loaded. Thank you, Özlem.
We didn't tell you that Ryan would have been asking this question. So very well done. And thank you so much for coming on our podcast, Özlem. And I think this conversation has been very, very interesting and thought-provoking.
Yes, thank you very much, Özlem. It was great to have you with us on our podcast and to be in touch with you again. I'm sure we will continue with these conversations in the future.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you to Ryan for that final question.
It was my pleasure. Marta, where can listeners go if they have any questions?
Ah, yes, Ryan, good call. For any questions, comments or suggestions, listeners can reach out to us via Twitter at laws-warcrimes. Send us an email at laws.warcrimes@graduateinstitute.ch and find us on our website lawsandwarcrime.com.
Great. Bye.
Thank you for tuning into episode 4 of Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know, with Özlem Olcan. All the books and articles mentioned in this episode are linked in the show notes. There you will also find our contact details and a link to our website, where you will find more episodes and read more about our Lethal Autonomous Weapons and War Crimes Research Project. Thank you for listening. Catch you in the next episode, where we will cover the question, can lethal autonomous weapons used by police respect human rights? Over and out.